Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
You are now listening to The Awakened Soul.
Welcome to The Awakened Soul. We got a special episode planned for you this week, which every episode of The Awakened Soul I would like to think is special because each one's a little different. We cover different stuff. You get deep conversation. But nonetheless, enough waxing poetic about this very own podcast. This episode is special because of the content. And that is the entirety of this episode basically is all based around mental health in the African-American and minority community. You guys are going to get a lot of information, a lot of stats, a lot of conversation. I have Dr. Erlise Ward, who's joining me for that conversation. Great lady. Me and her had probably talked for about 20 minutes even before we started recording, and a little bit after that too. She's just really, really a really dope person. So shouts out to her. Shouts out to Billy Ray Valentine as well for helping make this episode even possible. He worked so hard at bringing Dr. Ward into this so that we could have that conversation. I can't thank him enough for that one. Check out his podcast for sure. It's called The Infinite Fringe, especially if you're someone who sees the news and questions some of the stuff that's put out there. That's the podcast for you. And me and his conversations, he's called it going down the rabbit hole. And it's definitely that, because once you go down that path, it's very, very hard to ever come back. You will be questioning stuff for the rest of your life. So we're going to go ahead and get into our intro music. And on the other side of that, we're going to go off the rip with Hayes before we get into the meat and potatoes of this episode.
The awakened soul.
All right, so I'm not going to delay you guys hearing this amazing episode and this content for too long. I did want to address something we're working on for this week. This is going to be another two episode week because, of course, first of all, I'm a horror movie buff. I love horror movies. I love scary movies. Like, that's probably my favorite genre of movie. But nonetheless, Halloween is one of my favorite holidays, and I do consider it a holiday. So I have a dope Halloween episode coming to you guys midnight Halloween. So bring in your Halloween. Listen to that. I got a few different podcasters, a few different of my family, because they're from my podcasting family, sharing some of the scariest moments of their life. And that's not just in relation to horror movies. That's in relation to some real scary stuff that some of them have been through. So, you know, we got that. And then we also have a discussion on the top five horror movies of all time, our respective list. So be on the lookout for that Halloween. That's just in a couple days. I wanted to announce that. But with that being said, as The Awakened Soul is moving forward, especially with this episode, the content of The Awakened Soul is going to change a little bit. And when I say a little bit, I mean we're still going to do our music and reviews. We're still going to do our film reviews. We're still going to have the Stay Woke segment. It's everything that's there now is going to stay there. It's more about the evolution of the content itself. Like with the second episode, I believe it was, when me and Gerald discussed Luke Cage, it was more than just a review of the actual TV show. We discussed the cinematography. We discussed how it reflected the Black and African-American culture. And I want to get back to that. I feel like a little bit with some of our reviews, we got into just doing a straight up review on it. And I still want to provide that content. It's still going to be straight up reviews, but I want to get back into it being more of an introspective, so to say. So be on the lookout for that. Like I said, that's going to be changing a little bit. Let me know also, what movies would you guys like to hear covered? I got some things in the work with a few different people. I think you guys are going to like that a lot. Also, I need to reach back out to Awesome Nobody, to do some stuff. Shouts out to Awesome Nobody, by the way. Go and check out that episode if you didn't check it out. Go check out his podcast as well, the Movie Guru podcast. So definitely check that out. Yeah, but that's it. It's just the evolution of the Awakened Soul. We're gonna keep doing what we've been doing. I love the feedback I've been getting from each and every one of you guys. Love the iTunes reviews. I believe we have, I don't want to embellish, I think we're up to 15 or 16 all 5-star iTunes reviews. So shouts out for that. I mean, literally, this is episode 17. So we haven't been around for an extremely long time. The response has been crazy. It's been great. Also, Black Panther is coming. So be on the lookout for something big for Black Panther. Even though Ash from School and Life try to just categorize it as just a cartoon movie, which that turned into a whole ordeal. We got it straight. Me and my brother, the Mind of Ralph, got it straight, and Mike from the other podcast as well. So yeah, we had to get it straight on there. But it's all fun. Like that's part of what this whole podcast thing has been, more so than any other podcast I've done. It's the networking is really crazy, but it's not just networking in a business sense. Like, we all are very, very interactive, and I love the relationships that are being built there. So shouts out to all those podcasts. Shouts out to Oversaturated, the podcast, which is my favorite podcast next to the Next Level podcast, which is hosted by the Andrew Bello, and then School and Life is shortly following those two. And I know either Karen or Ash are going to get at me about, you know, mentioning them last, but nonetheless, I still love all you guys. But it's time. We're going to get into some very serious content. Dope discussion. Like I said, between me and Dr. Early Swartz, we're going to get into some intro music that should start right about now. Still in Andrew Bello's tricks, by the way. And on the other side of this music, it's going to be that conversation with me and Dr. Ward. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners to The Awakened Soul, we have a very special guest today for a topic that I hope everyone gets a lot out of. It's something that I've been wanting to do for a while. I think that it needs to be talked about and covered, and I couldn't ask for a better guest. So with no further ado, we're going to go ahead and introduce Professor Erlise Ward to The Awakened Soul. How are you doing, Professor?
I am doing quite well. I want to say it certainly is an honor to be invited to be on the show with you and your listeners. So thank you.
Well, we thank you a lot for just being willing to do this interview and take that time out of your day. Before we get into the topic that we're here to talk about, I want to talk about you a little bit and so the audience can get to know you some. And correct me if I'm incorrect here, but you graduated from the University of Wisconsin, correct?
That's correct. Madison. Yes, University of Wisconsin, Madison, because we have different locations. So that's why I'm just stressing the Madison.
Okay. And tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and what got you to want to go into this line of work. And also, I definitely want to talk about the No African Americans. The Oh Happy Day Depression Intervention, because I definitely want to talk about that as well.
Okay, certainly. So I'm a native of New York, Brooklyn, New York. I'm a Brooklynite. And living and growing up and living in New York, I would see people with mental illnesses. We have, you know, there's an increase in homelessness, and you would see folks, you know, sort of throughout New York, if you will, especially in the subway and on the streets. So started becoming sort of introduced to mental illness that way, just sort of seeing it sort of in the community. And in my education, worked with really great mentors who were focusing on counseling, if you will. And in my education, learning more about counseling, mental health, psychotherapy, started to see that maybe I may have a place, if you will, a role in working with individuals with mental illness. And I was raised with the old adage that to whom much is given, much is required. And I was able to get a PhD, therefore I had much, which then meant that much was required of me, hence my interest in psychology and really focusing on African Americans with mental illness.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then how did you get involved in the Oh Happy Day depression intervention?
Okay. So in my work here at the university, I teach and I do research, and I also do community service work. In the research that I had been doing, we started to learn more about African Americans and mental illness. What we had in the literature indicated that African Americans are experiencing mental illnesses at the same rate as Caucasians. When you look specifically at depression, they were experiencing depression at the same rate, if you will, but they were experiencing more disability associated with the depression. So my first launch into this was to do what we call descriptive research, and that involves partnering with the community to learn more about their perspective on these issues. And so in doing descriptive work with African Americans, I started focusing on their beliefs about mental illness. So what does mental illness mean to you? What are stigma or stigmatic views that you might have associated with depression or generally mental illness? And what are your preferred ways of coping? And in doing that research, we started to learn more about how African Americans are thinking about these issues, including that they're not as sort of aware and sort of mindful about mental illness. And when these issues come up, they don't see it as an illness or as a health condition in which you need to seek treatment for, right? And so with that said, given the high religious involvement within the African American community, whenever they thought something might be a little wrong or a little off, they would go talk to their pastor at church or people within clergy. So as I started learning more in the research with them, and what was powerful about this research is that I'm hearing directly from African Americans. So I'm honoring the voices and the concerns of that group. I learned sort of what sort of treatment they were most interested in, which then led to the Oh Happy Day class. And the Oh Happy Day class is a group counseling behavioral intervention. It is offered over a 12-week period. It is delivered by African American clinicians, and over the 12 weeks, we're focusing on different aspects of depression that is sort of relevant and unique to African American men and women. So that's how Oh Happy Day came about. It's important to note that Oh Happy Day was informed by African Americans.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's definitely important to know that was based in communication and talking to the African American community, which, you know, I will admit my ignorance originally to just how much mental health did affect the African American community, because just admittedly growing up, and a lot of conversation that you hear is it's kind of, you know, maybe generally believe that, you know, mental health is more of a Caucasian or a white person's issue, which it really isn't. And as I've gotten older and gotten more interested in wanting to know what was going on, it's, you know, to find that African Americans are 20% more likely to experience some serious mental health issues. That was surprising to me. What do you or can you shed any light on that number and that statistic?
Well, you know, I want to step back to say I'm glad you shared some of your personal sort of beliefs about this sort of growing up and not really having places to kind of talk about these issues and left with sort of the misperception that it doesn't happen to us. It doesn't happen to African-American folks. It's mostly Caucasians. What I let people know is that mental illness is an equal opportunity illness. It is a health condition that is not any different from cancer, diabetes, and other serious health conditions in that nobody's exempt, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's important to kind of get that message out there that no one is exempt from mental illness. Mental illness is now classified by the Institute of Mental Health as a brain disease. We all have a brain, right? Regardless of your race, your ethnicity, your gender, your sexual orientation, we all have a brain. And the fact that we have a brain means that we could be at risk at any point in time, if you will. And so going back to sort of the prevalence that we have among African Americans, they're, you know, 20% more likely. Given the society in which we live, we all are aware of sort of the history of African Americans within the United States. We are aware of racism, discrimination that has led to different disparities, if you will, especially in health. And so what we're seeing with regards to, you know, increasing rates of mental health issues among African Americans, there is some research indicating it's maybe correlated to our history, because we talk about social determinants of health, and that involves sort of the social issues you're dealing with, the environment in which you're living, place. There's the issue of place where you're living as well, socioeconomic status, education, income, and things like that. Those are factors that can impact our health, if you will, including our mental health.
Absolutely. And so I also in doing a little research myself, I came across the fact that 2% of psychiatrists and 2% of African-American psychologists, I should say, kind of make up the base there. Do you think that contributes to what seems like is a lack to kind of seek help in the African-American community?
Oh, certainly. We have found that in my research. People are African Americans nationwide engage in low treatment seeking, certainly because of the sort of misperceptions that we just talked about regarding mental illness. There's certainly the issue of stigma in the African American community. If anyone sort of think that you might have a mental illness, there's the concern about being labeled as crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So there's the stigma associated with mental illness. And then as it relates to treatment seeking, people are already apprehensive for those reasons I just mentioned. And then you go in and the chances of being assigned to work with an African-American clinician is quite slim, if you will. And so concerns there, and we are in the very early stages of developing culturally specific treatments for mental illness. And so when individuals go in, the treatment, the behavioral treatment that they are given access to may not be as culturally tailored, if you will, or culturally sensitive. And so people may try it for a little bit, and if it's not working, then they drop out. So we have low treatment seeking, and then even the ones who actually seek treatment, they're not necessarily adherent with the treatment. They'll start and stop, if you will. And so we have concerns there. There's the issue about the medication, side effects of the medication, and when people are not necessarily following the medication protocol once they start having side effects instead of going back in to see the prescribing doc, the psychiatrist, or even their primary care doc. They just go off of the medication on their own without getting the right kind of medical advice as how to sort of taper off of the medication. So what happens there is that people are then left with this negative impression, if you will, of treatment, both medication as well as psychotherapy. And so there's certainly need for education in that area, which is why I'm focusing in that area and I developed the Oh Happy Day class, because the Oh Happy Day class is education as well as treatment.
Okay. And so what are some of the, if us or our loved ones start feeling maybe signs of depression or anything else, what's the best way or that we can then go out and reach out for someone to talk to you? I guess it's a balance that we would have to strike if it's a loved one that we think may be going through some serious depression. But how do we try to maybe suggest that person go and talk to someone without feeling like we're judging that person, which is a big part of why people are hesitant to kind of seek help?
Right. Now, I think that is a great question, and I thank you for asking that question, and this would be helpful for our listeners as well. Yes, we may have family members, loved ones, people in our community that we may be close to that may indeed be struggling, right? Mm-hmm. So the first thing that we do is spend time with our family members, right, to indeed get a little bit more information. And then, and once you get a little bit more information, you're able to say, you know what, it's clear that you're not in a good place right now. And I think getting some help might be a first step here. I think offering the opportunity to go with that individual to the doctor, wherever they, the suggestion is to go, is excuse me, can be helpful. And you don't have to go to the session. You can just drive that person to the clinic and you wait for that individual. excuse me for 1 minute. The way mental health services are provided, you have to go, you usually start out with going to your primary care provider.
Okay.
And he or she will then provide a referral to psychiatric mental health. So I say, I always encourage sort of that partnership and really being there for family members. So the first place would be to schedule an appointment to see your primary care provider, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you do that, you go with that individual. You don't have to sit in on the appointment because we don't want folks to think you're invading on their privacy, right? So you drive them there as they feel comfortable, because some folks may be like, no, I got this, I can do this on my own. But off of that, just in case. And then the primary care appointment, and in that meeting, interaction with the primary care doctor, we ask for folks to be as honest and open as you possibly can. Let the doctor know that you have not been in a good place. It may have been, you know, a major relationship that ended, and you just have been feeling really sad, really frustrated about that. Or maybe a loss of a job or a loss of a significant family member, mom, dad, someone that you were quite close with. And then, you know, you just haven't been in a good place. You might have been feeling sad, feeling angry, don't have the energy to do the things that you normally do and enjoy. Because as you are open and honest in sharing that information, then the doctor will, he or she will then be able to say, okay, I think there might be some challenge, some mental health concerns here. I will then refer you to a psychologist, right? And then with that referral, then the individual will be going to a specialty mental health clinic. And oftentimes there are community-based clinics. if the individual is then wanting, again, more support for you to go with them to that appointment, then I would recommend doing that. Or if they say, no, I can do this on my own, I will schedule the appointment and move forward, then that would be the next step, to go to specialty mental health and, again, be open and honest in sharing sort of what has been going on. And then that psychologist, psychiatric nurse, or psychiatrist will then do a comprehensive assessment and then make recommendations by way of individual counseling, group counseling, the possibility of medication, and then sort of go from there and be adherent whatever the treatment is. If it's counseling, making sure that you are going to the treatment as is prescribed, or if it is medication, making sure that you're taking the medication as prescribed. So the advice to family is to seek treatment and do all of the things that is recommended by the clinician.
Okay.
And for loved ones, make sure that you are there to support them. It may be giving them a ride to the clinic and waiting with them for the appointment, but making sure that family members are there to provide the support as needed.
All right, I think that definitely hopefully drills the point home for a lot of people. I can speak to my personal experience. My younger sister, and I won't get into the exact details, but she was recently diagnosed with some mental health issues going on. And in me talking to her after the fact, and she said something that I had never thought about at the time. And that was, she was like, bro, I love you, but you know, sometimes when I call you, you'll ask me what's up. Like, I have to have something to talk to you about rather than just talk to me. And sometimes I just need you to just talk to me as my older brother. And that shook me a lot, because, you know, as being the older brother, I like to think that I've always been there for my sister, but it made me realize that sometimes I just need to slow down. And we all get caught up in the day to day lives, and, you know, me having kids, the hustle and bustle, so to say. But I think that it says a lot when you just are able to just make sure that person knows, regardless of what's going on, you're there for them, and you don't necessarily have to hear out or judge them, tell you the details. I think that, you know, just being that ear sometimes goes a long way. But that's, I just wanted to share that personal story. It was a wake up call for me, for sure.
Right. And I'm glad that your sister felt comfortable sharing that with you. And then you then with that information was able to reflect on that and say, you know what? I need to make some changes so I can be there for my sister. I can be present for my sister when she calls, and I can really listen to her. And that's important. That takes, you know, work to do. So I commend you on being able to engage in that reflection and make the changes to be there for your sister and support your sister.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's I just wanted to share that, because, you know, we never know what impact we may have on other people, and sometimes what is looked at as the smallest gesture. I mean, taking out an hour or maybe not even that much time to just talk about someone's day could really go a long way, and maybe open that door to them and being open with you about some things they're going through. So I just wanted to share that, definitely that personal story, because just hearing you talk, it just brought back that whole situation to me. But to kind of get back, I did see that, surprisingly, that African Americans that are below the poverty line are actually more likely to report or seek help for some type of mental distress. That surprised me. Why do you think that African Americans above the poverty line are more hesitant, it seems like, to actually seek some type of help?
You know, it's an interesting sort of dilemma, if you will, because you would think that people who have the means, the education, and access, that they are the ones that would be more open to seeking treatment, right? Mm-hmm. And then the ones who are sort of on the lower end, right, living below poverty level, are sort of more open to seeking, right? Is that sort of where we're at now, what we're kind of hearing? And I, you know, this is just speculation. I don't know of any specific research sort of addressing this. But initial thoughts are that, you know, individuals who are living below the poverty poverty level, they have sort of a high prevalence, if you will, of psychological distress, right? Because as you're living in poverty, right, you're struggling to pay your rent. There may be issues of food insecurity. There are issues of unemployment. You're sort of in between jobs, if you will. Family members, we don't know what may be going on there relationally. So these folks are really struggling, if you will. And as they're struggling, they're in touch with social services to try to get access to services. And in that process, then there may be the recognition with staff that these individuals are indeed experiencing psychological distress. It may be to the point of a mental illness. And then these folks are then sort of referring them to free services. So, for example, we have federally qualified health centers that provide services for individuals without health insurance. So these individuals sort of may have access to those services there, and that may explain why they're more likely to sort of be involved in getting care, if you will.
Okay.
And I also want to highlight that piece too, because when we talked about how you could help loved ones, and I mentioned, you know, going to see your primary care doctor, there's also the issue of, well, what if you don't have health insurance, right? Then the other option is social services, federally qualified health centers, and where they provide services for low-income individuals, individuals without health insurance. So going back to the poverty piece, so these individuals are sort of in and out of the system because they truly need help, right? And so you may have social service staff in contact with them and sort of pointing them in the right direction to get some of the services and care that they need. So that's sort of one guess as to what may be going on there. And then for individuals who are, you know, more socioeconomic status or sort of in better situations, who may not be seeking services. Again, there may still be the stigma associated with mental illness. There could be the issue of not having time to access services. Among African American women, there's the issue of the strong woman syndrome. Oh, the superwoman syndrome, if you will, where these African-American women are just so heavily involved in taking care of the family and providing for the home that some of their emotional needs may go unmet. And so they're so busy taking care of everyone else that whatever they may be struggling with takes a back seat. And so they're not actively seeking services, if you will. So that's sort of my guess as to what may be going on there.
Okay. And all that definitely makes sense. Better light than I could have possibly shed on it. So definitely thank you for that. Now you did mention women, and is there a clear, like a big gap in the statistics between African American men and African American women, suffering from any type of mental health issue?
Well, the areas where we see difference is with depression.
Okay.
And that goes across race, ethnicity. Women tend to be 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with depression. There's also the issue of, well, women are more likely to seek treatment, and because they're more likely to seek treatment, they're more likely to be diagnosed, right? So there's that factor. But what we do have in the literature is that we're seeing 2 times the rates of depression among women compared to men. And that is also consistent among African Americans.
Okay.
So that's one sort of clear cut area where we are seeing some gender differences. We also have, as we begin to look at bipolar disorder, where we have depression and mania, it's sort of equal there. We haven't really seen too much gender differences there. As we begin to look into the more serious types of mental illnesses, again, about the same gender-wise, gender spread.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's good information that hopefully the listeners all take to heart and use. The next thing that I do want to ask you about, and this was something that again, this opened my eyes. I never really made the correlation, but PTSD in the African American community, it seems to be of all ages, it seems to be more likely due to us being not prevalent is not the word I'm looking for, but more likely to be victims of serious crime than non-Hispanic whites. What are you seeing anything in regards to like a rise or anything in PTSD in the African-American community?
Well, we're definitely seeing increases for all of the reasons that you've mentioned. Exposure to crime, exposure to violence, and not only violence in the community, but also violence within the home, intimate partner violence. So children are growing up in those kinds of environments. Mom is also having to deal with those issues. So there's certainly those issues. And again, with the gun violence that we're seeing that seems to be increasing in our communities as well. We have folks who are experiencing that due to their own involvement or simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time, if you will. Those types of issues. As we think again about violence, sexual assault as well. So those are situations, traumatic situations that lead to the increase of PTSD. There's also the issue of that we see among veterans, and there certainly is an increase in PTSD among veterans who have been serving in our military, if you will, and we know that we have increasing rates of African American males who are in service, and we thank them for their service. But there's also increased risk because, again, of the trauma that they experience while they are in service. So definitely seeing strong issues of PTSD among veterans, regardless of race, ethnicity, and gender. But then as we bring it back to the African-American community, again, the increase in just violence within certain locations and certain communities, if you will, as well as within the home, increases the risk for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder.
And what are some of the ways or signs that you can notice if you may be suffering from PTSD?
Oh, great question. With PTSD, again, because of the issue of trauma in certain situations. So, for example, let's think about a woman who may have been sexually assaulted, right? Depending on where the assault happened, there are certain areas where you begin to see avoidance. There are certain areas where she may be unwilling to go, including areas, let's say there might be a supermarket relatively close by that she used to go to, that she needs to go to. She's not going to that supermarket anymore. Right. Mm-hmm. So with that, there's an increased fear, if you will, about doing certain things. Often there is a lack of sort of joy and pleasure, if you will. One of the classic symptoms that we see is what we call flashbacks, where people may have moments where they're sort of have a memory of what happened, and they become very anxious, very afraid. Sometimes they may have what we call panic disorders, where you feel like your life is truly in danger, and people may become very scared. So those are some of the classic symptoms of PTSD, where people are just really afraid or quite anxious, and the things that they used to do, they no longer do those things, and then they have the flashbacks, as I mentioned.
Okay. Like I said, that's something that it almost blew my mind reading that. I never really thought of PTSD and how that can affect. Of course, you know, for people who aren't really familiar, PTSD is almost solely looked at as something that happens to veterans and things of that sort. So it definitely was interesting to find out that it affects our community and the community in general more than just that.
Right. And I'm glad you mentioned that point, because yes, I think for a long time when we thought about post-traumatic stress disorder, we only talked about it in the context of veterans, right? People who are serving or have served in our military and have experienced combat, if you will. But now we have to think about PTSD within our community among people who are veterans who have not served, because the core sort of factor or risk factor for PTSD is trauma, right? And one can experience trauma sort of anywhere in our society, right? Like I mentioned, the guns, the violence, the sexual assault, sometimes depending on the type of racist act, that can also be traumatic, right? Some of the racial profiling that we have going on as well, you know. So again, increasing violence and being in situations where you may have experienced violence and that kind of trauma. So you're right. It's no longer for veterans, because we have those kinds of issues happening within our communities, which is just sad and very unfortunate, because when that happens in our community, everyone is sort of at risk, including young children, adults. So it is a major concern, especially now within the African American community.
Definitely. And you mentioned children, and, you know, I'm a parent, as we talked about before we started recording, and, you know, legacy means a lot to me. I had a whole episode of this podcast on legacy and what it means. But, I definitely want to, as our last topic, talk about, the suicide rate, and it seems to be rising amongst, African American youth and possibly youth in general. And, you know, I found a interesting statistic, on that. And it was that, African Americans are less likely to die from suicide, but it seems like, African American teenagers are more likely to attempt suicide than, any other race, at, 8% of African American teenagers, suffering from mental health, are likely to attempt suicide. What are some of the things you're noticing with that rate rising in our young people, which is definitely concerning?
Well, again, the trauma that these young folks are experiencing, because the one thing that I was going to get to with PTSD is also suicide. When you have PTSD, you are at an increased risk for suicide. Mm-hmm. So we have these young folks, these young African Americans, who are in communities where they are experiencing trauma, right? In all of the different forms. There's the issue of drug and alcohol. Right. So we have some of these kids that may be living in households where there are drug and alcohol related issues going on. Mom or dad may be addicted. Right. When that happens, the children are experiencing neglect and possibly abuse. There are then issues with food security, food insecurity. Right. Mm-hmm. We then have the fact that these children in those situations may be sort of an open home. Depending on what's going on in the home, there's no real supervision of the children. So the children are living in an unsafe environment, right? These children are developing trauma. And as folks begin to develop trauma, like as I mentioned, the symptoms include being fearful, avoiding certain situations. There's also depression associated with that, so the sadness, the lack of enjoyment in things. And then, as you begin to experience those things, then the question comes up about life. Why am I here? What is the point of me being here? When that starts to happen, that is evidence of suicidal ideation. What that means is that you begin to have thoughts about suicide. And some of those thoughts may be, well, my life isn't worth living anymore. Nobody really cares about me. My family would be better off if I'm no longer here, right? Mm-hmm. So when that begins to happen, these are individuals who are at an increased risk for suicide. And within the African American community, you mentioned that with especially teenagers, they're less likely to die from suicide, but they're more likely to attempt. And, you know, there's this literature indicating, and there are mixed reviews on this, that suicide attempt may be a cry for attention, a cry for help, right? There's that school of thought. And then there's also the school of thought that a suicide attempt is truly an attempt to end your life. to get away from all of this trauma and the stress. And as we say in the African American community, the drama going on in your life, mm-hmm. that one may legitimately see suicide as a way out. And it certainly is not a way out. But given sort of the emotional state of where people are and not making sort of informed decisions, they can lead to that point. It's also important to note that a significant percentage of people who attempt suicide or who are engaging in that kind of thinking and thoughts, oftentimes they are under the influence of a drug or substance. Because when that happens, you become impulsive. There's no real rational thinking, and so they're more likely to engage. So, yes, we are seeing those issues increasing in among African-American teenagers, if you will, and it clearly is a concern. So what do we do to help? We need to make sure that we are present for our young people, and present means that we are spending time with them and we're listening. We're asking, how are you doing? And we are listening. Because as you listen, you may begin to hear certain things going on that may be of a concern. In fact, I read some information actually yesterday indicating that 80% of the people who end up engaging in suicide actually said something to someone.
Wow.
And people may have missed it because they will say, well, I didn't know. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. Not recognizing that if you listen carefully, there are things that people might say. Like, you know, there's this really nice jacket that he bought and just really liked this jacket. And then he decided to give it to his cousin. Right? So they begin to give things away. And things that they used to enjoy doing, they're no longer doing those things. And they're isolating, just want to be alone. So really attentive listening and being present with our young people and providing support. And when you recognize that there are things going on at home that may be unhealthy for these kids, have a conversation with mom or dad. Check in with folks to find out what may be going on. Because these kids in those kinds of environments are at an increased risk for suicide and may not have a place to go, people to talk to.
And, wow, that's you saying that, you know, 80% they've said something to someone. That's just, you know, like I said earlier, you never know what really is a cry out for help for someone. But with teenagers, and this, I wanted to get into this because this is a lot of conversation going on amongst my own circle, and that I've couldn't really find any stats on. The social media and how it pertains to specifically teenagers, mm-hmm. and possibly depression and suicide. Are we seeing, are there any numbers out there that kind of correlate the two, or that shows maybe how social media bullying or anything like that affects teenagers going through depression?
Well, there certainly is sort of some, it's a new area, but we are definitely seeing that social media it can have a negative impact. Not to say that social media is bad, but there are aspects of social media that can indeed have a negative impact because there is cyberbullying that goes on. For young folks who are indeed experiencing depression, you know, symptoms of depression, sadness, loneliness, when it becomes severe, feeling like life isn't worth living anymore, some of those individuals, because of the loneliness, may seek out sort of support and engagement online. And in doing that, they're not necessarily doing it with people that they know, right?
Mm-hmm.
So again, that increases the risk for, again, bullying, developing negative relations, becoming in contact with people that may be unhealthy for them, if you will. And on social media, there are avenues where people share negative coping, right? Where people talk about, well, yeah, this is what you need to do when you're not feeling so good. This is what you need to do. And sometimes some of those suggestions may be unhealthy ways. You take a smoke, you know, get some weed. That helped me when I was going through my stuff.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense as far as sharing those negative coping mechanisms. Right. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
So it's important to be be supervising our kids. To be making sure that if you give them access to social media, that you're able to provide some oversight as well. So it's just the good old basic supervision of your kids, making sure that you are involved, you know what they're doing, who they're hanging out with, who they're spending time with, face to face, via the phone, via social network, and just really being involved with your kids and really getting a sense of what's going on with them. Absolutely. And as a dad, you understand that, the importance of just really being close with the kids and spending that time with them.
Absolutely. And as my son reaches, he's 11, as he reaches being a teenager, he recently asked for, I believe it was a Snapchat account, and I let him have it, and I monitor it. I'm all in his business. So I definitely, that's a balance that I guess I need to learn to work out between, not snooping, but snooping in a way that doesn't make him feel defensive. But, yeah, I have no problem. I'm all in his phone all the time. I'm sorry, son, if you're listening. But, yeah, I just feel like it's important for me to know what my son's doing. And, especially when you're on something like social media, I ask him about anyone he adds, and it needs to be someone he knows personally. So yeah, I thank you for that. You making that point made me feel a little bit better about being all in his business, so to say.
That is your responsibility as a dad, and it sounds like you are meeting your responsibility.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure how much he enjoys that, but you know what? It's better to know and be safe than not to, for sure.
Oh, and you know what? When he becomes an adult and he looks back on his life, you know what he's going to say? My dad was there for me. My dad looked out for me.
Absolutely. And that's how definitely my dad was. My dad knew everything that was going on with me. I couldn't hide nothing from him if I wanted to. So I try to be that same way. But yeah, I definitely do appreciate it, because looking back at it, like you said, it was my dad caring. I mean, that's what I see it as now. Regardless of how much I felt like it was an invasion at time, my dad cared about me enough to want to know what I was going through and always be there to talk to me about anything I was going through. So that's definitely, it can't be said enough how important that is.
Right. Critical. Critical.
And I do have one question for you. I did tell my listeners that I would be doing this interview, and there was one question that was submitted. All the other ones were ones I basically were already planning on hitting, but by one of my listeners, it was submitted that, how do you know when in a relationship with someone who's struggling with a mental health issue, when it may be time to stray away from that person? And that was a question that really it hit me, because I'm like, well, how would you know how you're maybe giving up on someone too early, and when it's unhealthy for you to stay in a situation like that? And if you could shed any light on that, please.
I think that's a really great question. And I think you partially answered that question in the question itself. You said when it's unhealthy to be in that relationship. And I think, that is a factor that we have to think about when, yes, you want to be there and you want to help that individual, and you make sure that you're, helping them think about, well, there might be a problem here. You might have to look into getting some professional help. I'm willing to accompany you there. Let me know how I can support you in this process. And so, yes, you're there helping in this relationship. It may be an intimate relationship. Right. That's what you're referring to. Not a family, but more of an intimate kind of relationship.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yep. And so as a partner in a relationship, you're doing everything that you can to help and support this individual. When do you know it's time to leave? When this individual doesn't seem to be really invested in getting the care that he or she needs, right? And then when your own health begins to be impacted, and then if there are safety issues, right? So, for example, let's say this is a couple where you may have a partner, let's say a male, and I'm not, being sexist here. I'm just sort of trying to provide an example that folks can relate to, where the male may be, abusing drugs, or alcohol. And the wife is saying, you know, or the girlfriend may be saying, you know, you clearly have a problem with alcohol. We need to get you some help. We need to get you involved with AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. We need to figure out how we can get you some help. And he's just kind of refusing to do that. And then there could be some abuse in the relationship, right? And when he comes home and he's drunk, then, you know, he's sort of yelling and screaming at her. Or if it's more serious, let's say he's, you know, addicted to crack, heroin, that kind of stuff, and he's needing money to support the habit, and he's coming home demanding money from her, right? Then we've got the issue of possible violence, intimate partner violence. And for this young woman, her safety is an issue. She's at risk. And so at that point, then yes, because your life is in danger, there is now a safety issue. That's when you have to say, it is probably best for me to come out of this relationship. Definitely. So I would sum that up by saying, you do what you can to help. This is a loved one. This is an intimate partner. You do what you can to help. And if this individual is invested and motivated in getting the help that he or she needs, then you can stick around and try to be a major source of support during a time of need. However, if this individual is not invested and motivated to get help, and then your safety is at risk, that's when you have to make some decisions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All great advice. Thank you for shedding that light into the listener who submitted that question. Hopefully, that helps you in your situation and make those decisions that you need to make, moving forward. It is a thin line between, helping someone else and knowing what is personally maybe causing you damage or harm. So that's a difficult decision for a lot of people to make, I'm sure.
Oh, indeed it is. And then there's guilt. And if after you leave, if something bad happened to that person, then there's the guilt of, well, I should have stayed on longer. I should have done more. There's all of that will come up. But at the end of the day, you have to think about your safety. And, again, it may be an issue of getting some counseling, working with a therapist that can kind of advise you and give you some healthy coping behaviors, healthier ways of coping and thinking through it. And so instead of being left with sort of dealing with guilt, the therapist is able to say, no, you made a healthy decision for yourself. Because at the end of the day, the only person looking out for you is you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great way to drill that point home. Professor Ward, I can't thank you enough for taking this time out, to have this conversation with me for the benefit of my listeners and anyone else who just happens upon this. Is there, before we close, anything else that you want to shed light on or make the listeners aware of before we, go ahead and say goodbye?
Okay. Well, thank you again for this opportunity. I would like to close with a statement by one of our former, Surgeon General David Satcher. He coined the term, there is no health without mental health. And that is just such an important statement, because it helps us to realize that without your mental health, what do you have, right? So for example, someone who's been diagnosed with cancer, if that individual is clinically depressed, he or she is just unable to participate in the required treatment. You're unable to get enough energy to go to your radiation appointments, to go to your chemotherapy appointments. So yes, you have the treatment for the cancer, but if you're not attending to your mental health, then that negatively impacts your ability to engage in the cancer treatment. So I like to put that example out there for people to say that there is no help without mental health. I will give you another example. To think about your mental health or mental health condition as a health condition that is not any different from other health conditions. Why? Because people can die from mental illnesses. When mental illnesses are untreated, they can die from it the same way other health conditions, when they go untreated, individuals can die. So again, if male has been diagnosed with prostate cancer and he's not seeking treatment, then eventually he will die from that. It's the same thing with depression. If you have depression and you fail to engage in appropriate treatment, then one might eventually get to the point of thinking of suicide, right, as a way out, and that individual can die from depression as well. So I'd like to put it out there to help people realize that a mental illness is not any different from cancer, diabetes, hypertension. Why? Because if those other health conditions go untreated, people can die. And it is not any different from mental illness. So the shame and embarrassment that we have about mental illness, we need to get away from that and recognize that a mental illness is not any different from other health conditions. So I leave you with that message of saying, there is no health without mental health. It is important and critical for you to attend to your mental health so that you can continue to engage in life and have a good quality of life.
I couldn't think of a better way to end that on. Thank you so much, Professor Ward, again.
You are more than welcome, and I thank you. I thank your listeners. I hope this information was helpful, and that we can improve some lives and save some lives as a result of the work that we did today. So thank you, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you, Professor Ward. And to the listeners, I really, really hope that you guys enjoyed this episode. It meant a lot to me to be able to even do this episode, that it all came together very nicely. I couldn't imagine it just coming across any better than what I felt it did. And like I said, I'm not a professional by any means. That's definitely why I wanted to have one on, to add that depth to the conversation. And I just hope you guys, you know, if anyone's in any situation, hopefully this podcast can help you. And if it helps even one person, then I feel like that was my calling. That was my purpose of doing this episode. So shout out to Professor Ward again for joining me for this conversation. And thank you guys. Thank you for the listeners of the Awakened Soul for just, you know, keeping me lifted and motivated and everything. Like, this podcast is just, I didn't think that it would turn into all it turned into since it started. And I owe that to the listeners. I owe that to everyone who's helped me contribute to this podcast. This is the episode. Like I said, I wanted the focus to be on that conversation. I definitely wanted to give that enough time. But we do have our Halloween episode coming out in a couple of days, so definitely be on the lookout for that. My usual cohorts are all throughout that podcast, so check that one out. This is the Awakened Soul. You can follow me at CEO HAIZE, that's CEO Hayes. You can also send me any email, questions, comments, concerns. Professor Ward did say that she would be willing to come back. We even talked about maybe doing something like this quarterly. So if you listen to this podcast and you have questions or things that you want answered, it's all hope is not lost. So I will be reaching out to her to come back, and you know, we'll see the questions that we get in. And you know, it's something that I'm definitely interested in doing, and luckily I'm blessed enough that Dr. Ward is also interested in doing this more than just the one time. So if you hear this and any questions come to mind, definitely send those in to me at theawakenedsoulpod@gmail.com, and we'll answer them on our next episode that we do on mental health and on anything else. Like I said, send me any feedback. Share the podcast. We're still trying to grow even more than what we already have, so definitely share it with a friend. And leave reviews on wherever platform you download it, if it allows reviews. I know Google Play does not. So if you get it on a platform that does allow reviews, please leave us a review. Let us know what you think about it. This is the Awakened Soul. I'm CEO Hayes. Thank you again for joining me. And I'll see you all again in a couple of days for the Halloween episode. Peace.
The Awakened Soul, a podcast brought to you from the mind of CEO Hayes.